Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security practitioners who will introduce themselves. And because we have a huge cybersecurity shortage, there was an article in Fast Company that says if you can pick up music, you can also pick up technology. What other backgrounds would be good for this industry?
Hey, this is Forrest, and I would say actually something that kind of goes along with it. I would imagine that, like, artists of some kind, I imagine would kind of have some of the similar brain power going on.
This is Mike Thompson, and I'm going to agree with Forrest. I've actually studied art in college and not technology, and I'm here now, so I agree wholeheartedly.
This is Mike Buckby, and I was actually going to suggest architects and people doing drafting and things like that. Those are very, I think, contemplative skills, and I think that would translate well.
They're very detail-oriented, too, because, you know, you don't want a building to collapse.
That's always a good thing.
Hey, we have our first podcast review from a person who's Rankin TJR. This person said that you guys were very knowledgeable and entertaining, never a dull moment, full of information, highly recommend for anyone interested in technology and specifically the security side of it. So good job, everyone. A nice pat on the back for being entertaining and sharing your experience with others in the industry. And because he was our first review, I sent him a pack of our InfoSec cards, which is based on the Cards Against Humanity card game. If you'd like to get a deck, go to iTunes and submit a rating and review, and we'll put you in the running for a deck. And so to learn more, please visit veronis.com/review. And so let's go to today's show. You know, what surprised me was that after the hackers took the entire fifth season of Orange is the New Black, they're going after Fox, ABC, National Geographic. And I looked at the cost of a breach and I saw that, you know, I would go with healthcare and finance. What were your reactions to this piece?
The thing that really jumped off to me is that Netflix did not pay. They just said, you know, we don't really care. We can't control every one of our vendors' security. And honestly, piracy is like in such a steady decline. There was an article in Wired about this same hack. And they said that basically in 2011, 23% of daily internet traffic in North America was related to BitTorrent. And that is down to under 5% today. So piracy is in decline. And a big reason for that is stuff like Netflix or Hulu are very affordable streaming services. So, you know, if such a small amount of people are pirating the show and using BitTorrent, why does Netflix care? You know, maybe Fox or some of the other networks that are maybe more advertiser driven and they need people tuning in to watch via traditional methods are more likely to pay. But Netflix is like the least likely person to pay. They have such a huge subscriber base. They're raking in the money. You know, this is a very small amount of people who are probably going to be pirating rather than just using the affordable Netflix service. So they just said, you know what? Not our problem.
I mean, I think that's kind of related to, you know, I think we're all at the age that, like, we were around kind of when Napster was around and, you know, that's where a lot of people got music. And then eventually, like, a similar thing happened with music where it was just easier, honestly, to buy music from what were some of the big ones, you know, iTunes and Amazon Music. Eventually, I think that's kind of Spotify has kind of taken over a lot of that, made it even easier. But for a long time, I think there was people who stuck with Napster and piracy of music really just out of, like, the convenience of it rather than the not wanting to pay at all.
I think that's exactly it. So much of this is almost like a user experience more than an economic thing, where $9 a month for Netflix is what, like 30 cents a day? You know, like that's not very much. So, you know, the piracy aspect of it isn't so much economic as it's something else. Like maybe it's, you know, people in other countries where there's still like intellectual property. They have all that stuff divvied up in weird ways where maybe it's not accessible there. But I think for security, try to tie this back some. I think so many of the security issues that exist and so many of the fixes for them are a lot of times user experience more than they are wholly technological in nature.
Cindy posed the question, why media as opposed to like healthcare or finance? And part of that might just be is like this small media company who's handling, you know, who knows, some sort of like, you know, post-production effects or something for a number of shows. they're probably less likely to have a huge security budget and put a lot of time and effort in towards that as opposed to a financial institution or a healthcare institution. So it was really just an easy target and a high profile one. I mean, certainly pop culture is huge. It's going to get recognition for the hackers. But as far as how much money is in that industry to hack, you know, it might just be more of the fact that it's an easy target rather than a lucrative target.
So, you know, I'm always dumb and my stupid catchphrase is the, like, what's the harm? Like, what's the harm? And an interesting piece of this is that we keep saying, oh, this is Netflix, the Netflix lost this. But really, it wasn't them. It was their supplier. But because, you know, they're the ultimate distribution point, they're the ones that get not the blame, but the notoriety. Because it's exactly as you described, Mike. So it's this like sub-supplier. Just trying to think of like risks and how all this stuff stacks up. That in the same sort of way, like, you know, there was the horrible United thing where that guy was dragged off the plane. And it wasn't technically United. It was like their subsidiary airline. And I think we see a lot of that where that it's the whole chain, you know, where there's this like brand dependency. And if any piece of it gets messed up, then you get the blame. So
is it like a vendor problem?
Oh, I think that's a really good way of describing it, that it's a vendor problem, that it wasn't Netflix that messed up. Like in this particular case, it was the media files. But say it was something else that was Netflix was about, like it was their payroll agency or it was some other service they used. You know, they're a public company. There's a lot of things that could happen to their stock price that if it came out that Netflix did something bad. And it reflects on that, even if it isn't directly in their area of responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually interesting, though. So, I mean, you talk about, like, what's the harm? And I feel like to Netflix, you know, we talk about them as contrasted to maybe financial or legal firms. I mean, to Netflix, I mean, how much of their value is based on trust? I would argue so much less than a financial firm, you know what I mean, or a legal firm. So a hit to their public perception of, you know, trust in, you know, Netflix being a kind of a secure steward of information when it comes to their own, you know, original series. I don't think most consumers really care all that much, you know, so I imagine that that trust hit probably wouldn't be as big a deal. And honestly, the financial hit of losing it, I mean, is not the same as, you know, failing to meet compliance and, you know, keep PCI data secure or something like that, just keeping your own internal series secure. Yeah, I think the what's the harm, I think you're absolutely right, kind of tells a lot of the story here. There's not nearly as much as there might have been of PCI data breach at a financial firm, you know?
It's kind of complicated because you can ask a vendor or someone you're outsourcing, oh, are you secure? Of course we're secure. And you kind of just go by their word, even if they have documentation. It's in terms of execution, you don't really know what's going on until it happens. So another surprising piece I found was a podcast where policy experts, they're discussing what nuclear security officers could learn from casinos. And I thought, well, if nuclear security people can learn from casinos, well, we InfoSec people can too. And so the most surprising thing I learned while listening to the podcast is that companies don't think that they have insiders, and what emotional creatures we are that it feels good to prefer to think that security breaches or problems and insiders won't happen to us. Because even if you do a background search on someone, you wouldn't think that they'd convert. What did you guys find most striking?
I like the detail that the floor security people in casinos don't have pockets on their uniforms so they can't sneak chips. I thought that was pretty interesting. But it really, you know, the interesting thing about that is that it's attention to detail from the ground up. You know, they said that they have their floor security teams, and that's a completely separate entity with no connections from the people who are doing surveillance on camera. So there can be no collusion, or at least not easy collusion, between these two departments. So, you know, they're taking every precaution to make sure that their money and their chips, you know, everything stays intact. They have a complete control over that, you know, process of everything from going to their vaults to making that stuff on the floor. And really, the story here is insider threats. They're focused on insider threats as just as big of a security problem as any outside threat. So I think casinos are a very obvious example of that, but it really drives the point home. Like you said, a background check only is good before they start their employment. You know, at that point, anything can change. So you need to have processes in place from the inside as well.
I think what's interesting in this is that, and maybe this is me drawing a line, just in my own mind, like in classifying the stuff, where there's organizations that have direct versus like indirect security concerns. Because, you know, you think about like a casino and they're dealing directly with money and they're worried about like that walking out the door. But then there's been a lot of cases recently, like there's this big case going on right now with Google's Waymo self-driving car versus Uber and the Lewandowski moved from Google. And when he left, he took 15,000 documents with him. They say that's worth $200 or $300 million because that's all the intellectual property of it. And there was less scrutiny on him leaving the company with 15,000 documents that represent maybe the future of these large companies than there was someone taking a $10 chip out of a casino, even though it's hard to think of it like that. To me, that was the interesting part, is like, how can we make the indirect, maybe intellectual property values like treated the same way as, you know, you do a relatively cheap poker chip.
So while nuclear security people are worried about potential explosions, one thing computer security people are worried about are vulnerabilities that enable people from the outside gain access to an admin account. And there's an article you found, Mike Buckby, that's super important to share. Please inform the public.
So this was about Intel's active management technology. And so in the chipsets on some of the boards that they put out, they have Intel Active Management Technology, AMT. And so this is like a branded technology that they include as part of their stack of things. And there is a privilege escalation vulnerability. And so it's entirely possible for someone to remotely take over at a very low level all of these different systems. And this has been going on for years. And then once that management control is in place, all sorts of, you know, things can be done. The easiest one to think about is just they can turn everything off or reformat the disks or create a huge issue for a host or someone just trying to get things done. And the reason I thought this was so interesting is that this is an area that we don't typically think of. Like, you know, when you think of like, oh, I'm going to install the operating system, I'm going to put antivirus and endpoint security on it, I'm going to use, you know, Varonis to manage the permissions and things, you don't normally get down to like, oh, well, is the chipset, is the motherboard here, is this an issue that we need to be really concerned about? It's just overlooked a lot.
You know, this is one of those examples of where good security policy isn't just about, you know, locking things down necessarily, but also just keeping things up to date. Even the things that are honestly sometimes kind of a pain to keep up to date, in this case, the firmware. I mean, you know, it's important to kind of keep a schedule and keep these things, you know, just kind of have, you know, every month, every 2 months, whatever it is that you determine. But like, the only way you can address this is by updating the firmware. And this goes for all kinds of appliances you might have in your environment. So, you know, having kind of a policy in place to periodically do that is vitally important alongside any other part of security.
I mean, I think it's one of those things that people are also hesitant to do. I mean, I've been part of firmware upgrades on firewalls that then we lost the firewall configuration and it was a disaster. Like, people are scared of doing that. So it's kind of like, yeah, we'll do the server patches, we'll implement new policies, whatever, but maybe something like firmware, they might do it eventually, but it's not like they're keeping on top of it regularly like they would other security issues. So it's nice that this stuff gets publicized, but
oh, I'm not saying it's not tricky. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, it does need to be done, you know, and if you have to set up a maintenance window and do it on a Friday night or something like that, well, you know, sometimes that's the way to do it.
What's interesting to me is like what this is drawing out are like all of the normal issues you have with any kind of patch, except this is like even more so. Like, production system trying to apply a patch is risky in some ways, that it changing the current state of, you know, something that's known good to be working well, but it has this issue. And there's some risk there. And with the firmware updates, I agree, like, it always seems risky that you're going to brick the device, that, you know, it's not going to come back upright, that something else is going to go wrong. To me, what this points to especially is, you know, you were describing it for us. Like, I don't think it's talked about a lot, but how DevOps compared to, you know, an older style of system administration really has security benefits, where, you know, the DevOps ethos to have everything programmatic, to have just a command you run that spins up the servers and kills the other servers and, you know, moves things around, makes things like this much more doable because it's something you practice a lot more often. And, you know, things like firewall rules and things would just be at some level, you know, that it's, you know, executed instead of, you know, documented and then re-entered by hand. So
Oh, yeah. I mean, keeping a backup of your, you know, Cisco configs and whatnot, I think is, you know, also vitally important and kind of goes into it for sure. But, you know, that's something you could be, you know, scripting and, you know, from a DevOps perspective as well.
I'm just thinking about the next article that it's not even a process tricky thing. It's where IBM, they accidentally shipped USB drives to their customers that totally messes up your machine. And we've joked about using USBs at trade shows to get people's attention. And so I'm just wondering how unfortunate that you can buy a bunch of USBs and then it can potentially come pre-infected and you wouldn't even know it. And how unfortunate. What happened to quality control?
You know what this reminds me of? That one kind of, I don't know, attack vector of leaving a compromised USB drive in the parking lot on the ground of whatever kind of company you're trying to, you know, infiltrate or something, because, you know, you figure somebody non-technical might pick that up and just kind of be curious what's on it. There's some really high profile breaches that have been caused by nothing other than a USB drive.
I mean, didn't the Stuxnet virus that took down those
centrifuges.
Yeah, they that was USB. Like, I think that, you know, it spread all over the place, but didn't activate until it was on the right system. But I think they had to get through the air gap network by just hoping a USB stick eventually got plugged in on their network. I mean, to be fair, I've plugged in random USBs. I've found USBs before, not necessarily on the street, but some of my earlier jobs cleaning out the IT closet that hasn't been touched in a while and say, oh, look at all these USB sticks. I'm going to plug one in and see if any of these are worth me using. You know, I've done that. And in this case, you know, I would certainly, if I got sent one directly from IBM, I wouldn't question it. I mean, this was to initialize their store-wise disk racks. Like, I wouldn't even think twice.
They were attempting to do the firmware update we just talked about. So. Yeah.
Exactly. You can't win.
This never ends.
I don't know. I don't know what the answer is there. I guess, you know, scanning every USB you plug in, maybe on a machine that is not connected to your network, you plug in the USB, you try and run some sort of virus scan on it. Hopefully it's something that detects a Trojan or whatever was on this USB. But I mean, that is really thinking about every step of the process. And I would be the first to admit that I would probably not do that myself. It's scary. It's scary.
Well, I think what's scary is, and you know, it's kind of funny, like, oh, IBM, they did this, but it's not like they were incompetent. It's not like there aren't smart people that work there. Like, and unfortunately there's no way of knowing like why or how this occurred. If it was something deliberate, or insider from someone at IBM, from, you know, a three-letter agency, from a malicious group somewhere that was trying to get into this stuff, from the USB drive manufacturer that they bought all of these from, there's just no way of knowing. And I think it's, what makes it so disturbing is just like, where does your level of paranoia end?
I feel a little dispirited introducing our next article about IoT devices, because there was that HBR article on why IoT companies keep building devices with huge security flaws, right? So that's what regular people are asking. Why can't you get security right? Why do we keep making these things with huge security flaws? And maybe it's clickbait. Maybe it's so that I would talk about this article or people would read it. But it's a business-centric publication. And so that's how they're seeing IoT devices. You know, security flaws, it seems so apparent and it happens all the time. And they voice privacy by design. They voice security by design. They voice software updates and perhaps a better communication method when it comes to delivering security notifications. And do you think the listed recommendations are the answer, or that new businesses need to develop better production processes? And nobody's doubting that the people who work at IBM or the people who are creating these new innovative technologies aren't smart. I'm wondering, how should we go about approaching it so that we're not seen as irresponsible security people?
I swear, every time IoT comes up, it's always kind of a question of like, well, the market is not really demanding that IoT be secure. You know, I don't feel like sort of the incentives in the market are there that are making people, you know, as these devices are, you know, designed, and sold, you know, to actually put that much, you know, work into the security of it. Because I don't actually think that, you know, if that was a design goal, it would be necessarily all that more difficult or expensive to really incorporate it. It's just not there, I think, because it's not part of the, you know, the end goals that kind of the market wants. I mean, none of the parents, I think, who bought those teddy bears before the articles came out about that were, you know, kind of looking at the box, like wondering what the security standards were on, like, the, you know, the wireless connection. So, I mean, I just don't know how persuasive this article will be to some of these companies until the market kind of wants them to be that way.
But then people are freaking out. Last week we talked about Unroll Me, and people are looking at our data.
Yeah, people say that, then they give Facebook all their data willingly. I don't know. I'm pretty pessimistic about this. I agree with Forrest. I mean, the reason that companies keep building insecure devices is because there's money in it. And until there's not money in it, they're not going to change their tune. You know, I agree with the point in the article, which was that, you know, government regulation is slow and it's not going to keep up with rapidly changing technology. Just because it's insecure doesn't mean people are going to stop doing it. You know, why do they build high-rise condo buildings here in New York City that don't meet, you know, building code or don't have sound construction methods? Why? Because it's cheaper for them to do and they can make a lot of money doing it. And technology companies, unfortunately, aren't any different. They don't really care about you and I's data until it comes back to bite them and they have to pay a fine. So until they start getting punished by the market or by some sort of regulatory agency and it hurts their bottom line, I don't think we're going to see secure IoT devices, at least on a widespread basis. There might be some niche players that really focus on security. I talk about it a lot, but Apple's like HomeKit ecosystem is very secure compared to most Internet of Things devices. But you know, that's not something you would find across the whole industry.
HomeKit is an interesting example in that part of the reason it hasn't caught on more, I think, is because it is more secure, and therefore there's more of a process in terms of getting something certified to work with it and to be in that ecosystem. And the one, I think, you know, kind of positive out of that article was that they were all pointing to the framework for improving critical infrastructure cybersecurity from NIST, the National Institute of Science and Technology. And I can see parallels to, like, when they're first started to be, you know, electronic devices, like any kind of electronic devices, and people would do dumb stuff and get shocked. And so then there were, you know, consumer electronics standards, and there's a CE stamp on everything, and there's at least some level of, I don't know if it's exactly regulatory, but there's at least something that says, like, oh, there was some thought put into this and some testing. And I think, you know, maybe the frameworks can help with that, that at least there's something that says, like, oh, this is some thought was put into this.
I love the frameworks. I think they're thoughtfully created.
And they're a lot of fun. You know what I mean? They're just a lot of fun, too.
I actually enjoy writing them and reviewing them. But, like,
oh, of course.
If I was an IoT maker, I'd look through them. Any last thoughts before we move on to Mike Buckby's tool of the week? No. What do we have, Mike?
So this week, I was going to suggest people check out the Pi-hole. It's pi-hole.net. And so we talked a week or so ago about a capture utility that you can make for doing network packet inspection with a Raspberry Pi. And so this is sort of along the same line. So the Raspberry Pi is this very low cost computer that looks about the size of a pack of cigarettes. And in this case, the Pi-hole is a network-wide ad blocking server. And I bring this up because there was a real interesting thing I read about someone who is using this. And among other things, it lets you look at all of the DNS traffic, because that's really what it acts as, is a local DNS server on your personal network at home. And he noticed, oh gosh, what are these other devices that are making all these crazy calls? And was able to track down some infected devices on the network in a way that isn't always real clear otherwise. It was interesting for a couple reasons. And I think the more people do with hardware and software and configuring their own network, things like local DNS, the smarter they'll be and better off everybody will be. So, Pi-hole.
Thanks, Mike Buckby, Mike Thompson, Forrest Temple, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you want to follow us on Twitter to find some of the stories we're discussing, you can find us at infosec_podcast. Thanks, and we'll meet up again next week. Bye.
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 Bye, guys.